This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And here's what I'm going to say. It's raining outside. I just know there's mushrooms growing in the woods. And unfortunately, I am not able to go look for them. I'm pretty bummed this spring, actually, not being able to participate in a couple of these activities because of my knee. When you're listening to this, today is, when I'm recording this, is April 15th. I am 3 weeks post, 3 weeks post op, and my knee's getting better, but, I'm just bummed that I'm missing youth turkey season. I'm, bummed that I am missing mushroom hunting. I'm bummed that I can't coach baseball. I'm bummed that I have to stop and slow down and the rest of the world keeps on moving. So, that's kind of what's going on, but every day is getting better. I'm kind of looking forward to this part of my life being over with and I can get back. I'll tell you this, man. One thing about this period in my life, this scenario that I'm going through is I've been taking for granted mobility and like being able to move around a lot and just stand up and sit down with or without pain and that kind of stuff. And then I look like at my 80-year-old grandma who has to deal with it every day. And I'm just like, I got to be thankful right now for what I have and that my knee is getting better. I go to therapy with a guy who he's really struggling. He's a bigger, older gentleman, and he seems to be struggling because I'm guessing maybe his age and his weight. And here I am. I've already hit a lot of my goals after 3 weeks that you should be hitting after 6 weeks. So I know I'm ahead of schedule. My doctor or my physical therapist, he's already told me, he goes, hey, listen, you already have enough bend in your knee that you're going to be able to climb a tree stand, fairly soon if you need to. So I just have to get rid of this tightness, build up some more strength in this leg. And, I think I'm going to be okay, dude. And, it just sucks because life keeps going and I'm slowed down right now. And, anyway, got to get over that. So, before we get into the rest of this episode with Derek Craig, a great episode, great BS session. We BS about the hunting industry, about the hunting community. We talk about life in general. We both have gone through this not drinking stage of our life and what that means to us. And we talk about that towards the end of this episode. But before we get into that, I got to send a huge thank you to the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. First and foremost, Wasp Archery. I've been a partner with Wasp for a very long time, and they make some amazing heads. And one thing that I want to say about Wasp broadheads is most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, and I think that plays a huge role in their durability and their lethalness. And to be quite honest with you, and this may not be like the kosher thing to say, but when I put a broadhead, I'm just going to say what I'm thinking because that's what I do. But when I put a broadhead through an animal, I want it to fuck that animal up as much as humanly possible. And that's what my experience with Wasp broadheads have been. So before I say something I shouldn't, go check out wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list, Vortex Optics, amazing company, amazing optics. You still have plenty of time to go to vortexoptics.com, check out their turkey red dots or all of the red dots you can put on your turkey gun. They got the scopes and the red dots for home defense and tactical. They got got anything you, any optic you need as a hunter, they got it. They have their VIP warranty. So go check out vortexoptics.com. Code Blue Sense right now. I'm a little pissed because I knew this rain was coming. And of course I have my knee issue, but I was hoping that I would have more mock scrapes freshened up by now, because one thing that I've noticed, when using the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit from Code Blue is when there's a lot of moisture in the ground, they seem to hit the scrapes more than in really like dry and droughty type weather. So, go check out their Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit. Go check out their scent elimination products. Go check out their real and synthetic deer urines. CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Reveal trail cameras. Reveal is doing it and doing it. And like they're doing it like an LL Cool J song. And they're doing it wild. And so, whether it's their new cameras or their new platform and the updates that they're coming up with and their what I like to call continuous improvement. That's a lean manufacturing term, but continuous improvement on their products and their platform. It's a no brainer to be using these products, especially if you are trying to manage a property or just kind of get a feel for a property and you don't live close to it. So, a cellular trail camera can tell you a lot about what's going on your farm when you're not there. Go check out tacticam.com/cameras, and the Reveal app can be downloaded anywhere you download apps for your phone. So go check that out. And then last but not least, I got some t-shirts left over. So go visit fullsneakgear.com. And I believe I'm running a 2-for-1 special right now. So buy one t-shirt, get one free. You can do that at fullsneakgear.com. Go check it out. Good vibes, everybody, and enjoy this podcast. All right, everybody. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today I am coming to you semi-live. I guess it depends on when you are listening or watching this, from the bed where all three of my children were conceived. So
that's awesome.
I'm 3 weeks post knee replacement surgery. I'm getting around a little better. I'm going through a stage where like my IT band on my right side is really tight, all the way down to my ankle. My ankle and hip are starting to bother me as I start to become more mobile. I'm walking without a crutch even a little bit. Physical therapy is although I feel like it is, I feel like it sucks. My physical therapist just continues to assure me that I am way ahead of schedule, and that a lot of that has to do with how early on in my life I got this surgery. So I'm doing that. The only issue now for me is sleep, and I'm just running through this recap real quick. Sleep, and then the hardest part is, when you get a surgery like this, your life completely stops and everybody else's life does not stop. So that is a huge, huge frustrating point for me, is to try to keep like trying to be a dad and a husband and somehow trying to continue to contribute to the family, with all that. And literally not being able to. And then that obviously causes frustration, because dad and husband, all the stuff that I've been doing in, you know, over the past, you know, year, whatever my contributions to the family are, just kind of disappear for the time being. And it kind of is frustrating for others. So with all that said, today's guest is Mr. Derek Craig. And that was a long intro, and I do apologize, there, Derek, but, thanks for taking time out of your day to hop on the podcast. Why don't we start off at the beginning and we just say, why don't you talk to us a little bit about where you live and what do you do for a living, man?
Yeah. Well, hey, man, thank you so much for having me on. Listen to you. Long time listener, first time caller, that old joke.
There you go.
Yeah. So been following you for a long time, and it's funny, as you and I were kind of exchanging going into this, we know a lot of the same people, and I've worked in this hunting space for a long time, but some generalities about me is, I'm 56 years old. I live in, Northeast Indiana. married for, oh boy, 32 years, which is shocking that she's put up with me that long to a wonderful
wife. I had my wife. 14th yesterday, my 14th wedding anniversary yesterday.
I vaguely remember those days. Yep. I have two adult age daughters. They will be, they're 24 and 26 right now. They'll be 25, 27 this summer. So they're pretty awesome young ladies. Yeah, so avid deer hunter, mostly, you know, mainly bow hunt. I mean, I rarely take out a gun, although I did shoot a deer with a gun this past year. Primarily bow hunter for turkeys. And, you know, I've really kind of got my start in the hunting industry back in about 2008, 2009. I kind of broke into it, through the turkey hunting, bow hunting turkeys primarily, was going down the, I had killed so many turkeys with a shotgun over the years through the 90s and early 2000s. And I was like, man, this is, I hate to say this. I mean, but I was like, this is easy. I mean, and back then, obviously, you didn't have the hunting pressure that you have now. And I mean, the whole dynamics of hunting in general were totally different back then. And so I wanted to start bow hunting them, and I was body shooting birds and losing them. And the guillotine came out that was the four blade head chopping head that had these green straws that stuck to the blades. And we were struggling to get them to fly and really struggling. And I just happened across Magnus Broadheads, and they were coming out with their bullhead at the time. And so the owner and I just hit it off. And so that was my entrance into the hunting space. And so, you know, I work actually for Magnus Broadheads in the hunting space. And then I worked for a lot of other brands doing photography work, video work. I mean, brands like Huntworth and Hotshot Archery and Darton and Spy Point. And I used to work a lot for Dave Smith Decoys before Meat Eater bought them. And there's just been a slew of brands, you know, over the years that I've worked with. And so it's been a fun career. But, you know, really what got me into all of that was video and my kids, because both of my daughters, as I mentioned, you know, they're adult age now, but when they were little, I was like the dad, like, hey, let's just grab a video camera and film them. I want to record these memories. And so I started recording them. And in my real life, I'm actually an engineer. And so, I have a job that I still work today. I'm a forensic engineer. So when something happens to, say, a large structure, I go in and investigate, okay, what was the cause? How far did the damage do go and all this stuff? And then I write reports and I report back to, say, insurance companies or attorneys, saying, hey, here's how we fix it. Here's where we go from here, that type of stuff. It's kind of a fun job. Well, it is a fun job, actually. I mean, in all my years of engineering, it's probably my most enjoyable career job. I say all that being an engineer, I have a nerd brain sometimes. And so when I start filming my kids, the engineer nerd in me just went down the rabbit hole. It's like, well, if I can shoot decent video on a $150 camcorder that I picked up at Walmart, what could I do with a $1,000 camera? What could I do with these microphones or this and that? And so I spiraled down this nerd rabbit hole on camera, filming, photography, editing. And it was just like this snowball effect that just grew. And then that opened up those doors into that hunting space. And, you know, and ultimately led me to, again, you and I knowing many mutual people. And it's funny, we were talking before, I don't know how we've not crossed paths, but that's kind of my generalities about me in general. So, yeah, love to shoot video, love to shoot animals with a bow and arrow. And
yeah,
you know, so
I got a question for you. I don't know why this is my follow-up question to this, but it sounds like you've been participating in the hunting space for a lot of years, and especially in the photography, videography, editing. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Which is always something that has really interested me, and from not necessarily from the quality of any pictures or something like that, but who gets the shot? You know what I mean? Like, how does a good photographer in this world stand out? Because I went through a period of time where I tried to be a photographer in this space and videographer in this space. And I'm biased, and I felt I was taking and crushing some really good pictures. But my problem was, I wasn't friends with the people in the marketing space who were handling that. And it always felt like the marketing guy had a good friend or a buddy who was also doing what I was doing. And that's where it went. So it was almost less about how good I was at something and more about who I knew or didn't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. And I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like that was an obstacle for you?
Oh, I still feel that way to this day. I mean, in some regards, but there reaches a point where anymore, it's like, I really don't care, if that makes sense. Now, early on, yes, that's frustrating. And that, boy, and I know some young photographers who are incredibly gifted. And their frustration, I totally get it. But sometimes all it takes is just a door opening. And for me, it was total happenstance. I mean, you know, again, like I was saying, I was trying to head chop these turkeys and it wasn't working out. And I was videoing. I mean, obviously not near the level of what I can do now or, you know, edit or anything like that, like I can do now. And the opportunity just happened that Magnus was developing a head chopping head at that time. And the owner, Mike Somm, happened to be a very, like, he was on Archery Talk and a lot of these other spaces himself, where you don't get the president of XYZ, you know, big company on a lot of these spaces to talk to. And I reached out to him with questions, and they were engineering questions. And then I filmed a hunt. He's like, holy cow. And he's like, well, you're an engineer. So it was, in a lot of regards, it was blind luck, that first entrance. But what happens is that was just blind luck there. From there, it was all hard work after that. You know, that was the initial. Sometimes you just need a door to open, and it was happened to be total timing. And you hear that in a lot of different aspects of life and careers and where things go and how did somebody, you know, become super successful in whatever business opportunity or buying land. Like, how did somebody acquire 5,000 acres of land? Well, you know, who knows, 20 years ago, a little crack in a door opened and they took it when others wouldn't and just progressed. And that's all it was. But yes, I still see that to this day. And what I can tell you is my involvement with a lot of the other companies over my pseudo hunting industry career has been kind of putting myself in the right place at the right time, but also delivering quality work and then trying to look at things I'm with a creative eye. And I know so many talented creators and so many that are just even more creative than I am. And I watch that and I admire them. And I was having conversations. I was at the Iowa Deer Classic and the Illinois Deer Classic doing some work out there. I was talking with some of my creator friends out there who are a lot younger than me. I mean, I'm talking, you know, 28 and 30s. And I had a long conversation actually with Chris B. He and I were talking about some stuff. And I was like, man, I'm so envious of some of you guys and, you know, and just talking to these different creators that I know. And because you're in the age class. And then they, in turn, they'll tell me like, well, man, we were when I was like 18 years old or whatever, 17 years old, I was watching your stuff on YouTube and you were an inspiration for it. And I'm like, you're like, holy shit, I never even thought about something like that, you know? And so, yes, you're right. There's a lot of luck involved. There's a lot of knowing the right people. Obviously, you know, for example, I'll tell you this, that like how I got into Huntworth happens to be because I'm friends with Nate Sellers, who is their marketing director. And how I became friends with him was he owns Average Jack Archery, a YouTube channel. Well, many, many years ago, he came to ATA and introduced himself to me because he was a huge fan of my content. I didn't know him from Adam. And we struck up this friendship. And then he comes and he hunts with me and we do all this stuff. And he knows that I do creative stuff. And when he took that job at Huntworth, he was like, dude, he goes, he's a lot younger than me. You know, he's in his early 30s and he was consulting me about like, hey, I don't know if I want to make this change in career of leaving a teaching job and going and doing this. And I was like, dude, you got the ultimate parachute. If it doesn't work out, you can become a teacher. And through that, he was like, when he took the job, he goes, I got one condition. You got to come with me. I need a photographer. So again, yes, it's who you know, but it's how you got there. It's not like I've been buddy, you know, it's a weird dynamic. But yes, that's a long answer to your question. It exists. It's frustrating. But I think that exists everywhere in life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that went through and I think the hunting industry is a perfect example of this, because it might be true in any other industry or any other product in the world, but the hunting industry is much smaller than, let's say, like the automotive industry, or some people have passions about cars and engines and things like that. But there's a lot of people that have a passion for hunting and want to work in the space. As far as the size of the hunting community and the hunting space is relatively small compared to like the automotive industry or things like that. And so there was this flood of all these people. And I think what really made it a flood is when the cameras became easier to use and took higher quality images. And you didn't necessarily need, because I'll tell you what, when I fronted the money for my Canon, Mark III, that I had, dude, that took amazing pictures. And I instantly started taking pictures of like families and kids and, you know, like a photographer. And I also started doing some other photography on the side. I started doing weddings, and it wasn't necessarily because I was a stud, but the camera did a lot of the work for me. And then I learned to edit, post and do that. Yeah. And it became easier to use. And that's when I noticed like a huge flood in the hunting space of all of these people trying to come in at one time, and it created a bubble per se.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. It definitely did. And those tools do make your job easier. Just as like if you were a car mechanic, yeah. Okay? Like if you're going to work on a car with an old rusty crescent wrench that you got from your grandpa many years ago, it's going to be a lot more difficult than if you go and get the latest and greatest set from Snap-on or whatever and all yes. And you are totally right when it comes to camera gear. But at the end of the day, it still is the monkey that's running the camera. Yeah. That's the person with the creative eye. I have a good friend of mine. He was kind of my, he was kind of taught me a lot about photography and video. And we met again through hunting. He had like some questions about turkey hunting and stuff. And since then we became friends. We lived about 30 miles apart, still do. And he is a professional photographer and videographer, like legit. Like he got me in 2012 when the Super Bowl was in Indianapolis. He got me there to the media day of the Super Bowl on a media pass so I could film and stuff, because he shot video and photographs for the NFL. So I was standing 10 feet from Tom Brady, you know, and Eli Manning and all these, you know, NFL stars. He is a photographer for the Tampa Bay Rays. He is the video and photography. He's like some high up for Notre Dame football. And I say all this because if you hand him an iPhone, I guarantee he can compose and shoot a photograph better with that than say I can with my Sony mirrorless gear and high-end lenses. Right. Because it comes down to, yes, the tools do make it easier for you and I or somebody else to shoot quality video and photo. But at the end of the day, it's the monkey behind that camera and it's the creative eye. And what I see too much is people in the hunting space, whether it's video or photography, all they look for inspiration is people in the hunting space. They pull up an advertisement that X, Y, or Z brand does and go, oh, I want to create that shot or do this or do that. And what I tell people a lot of times is, I don't consume a lot of hunting content. I don't look at a lot of that stuff. I'm aware of it. And I have certain creators that I kind of follow their stuff because I'm intrigued, but I look beyond the hunting space. I look at extreme sports. I have a background as a kid. I was involved in BMX and BMX freestyle through the 80s and early and through the 90s. Yep. So I look a lot of like X Games, action sports, Red Bull stuff, content, creators online, like Peter McKinnon and all these guys who have nothing to do with hunting. And I go, man, how can you apply their creativity to the hunting space and get that look or that feel in an image or a video? And so again, it becomes the monkey behind the camera. Yeah. But the gear does, it makes it a hell of a lot easier. I mean, it does.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
I tell you what, back in the day, when I was, I don't even, it would have been like late 80s and early 2000s. Early 90s. I remember this, that was probably right around the birth of extreme sport, quote unquote, extreme sports. And I remember getting my hands on this like freestyle skateboarding street where they would just skate around a big city like New York and grind and things like that. And then, as time went on, one of the people that I love following is Jimmy Chin. Do you know who he is?
Yeah, I know
like
who he is.
The mountaineering guy who is a photographer, but he's at like, 18,000 feet and doing all that stuff. I looked at a lot of that and, I was like, man, it would be cool if hunting could absorb some of that style, right? Yeah. What I always found interesting is, let's talk a little bit how marketing has changed in the hunting space from maybe like the 2009. Do you remember the period of time when the all the hunting videos were like gore? I don't want to say gory, but like blood and heavy metal music, where it was like, here, some guy's in a tree stand and he's going, all right, today I'm on this food plot here. And then the buck pops out and it's like, and I'm just like, I can't relate to that because although I love heavy metal music, I could not relate. Like, it didn't catch that vibe for me of like when a white-tailed deer is tiptoeing through the woods, I'm not getting heavy metal vibes, but that's what all the people were doing was this real heavy metal vibe. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I do. There's been so many trends. In fact, it's funny, just the other day, I was watching some old Primo stuff because, I hunted in Africa this last summer for the first time. And I'm planning another trip in a couple of years. And I happened upon, some Primo stuff where they went to Africa. It's been over 10 years ago. And I was like, I just want to watch it. You know, I mean, being a product of hunting TV in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, Primos and Will and those guys were awesome. So I'm like, well, I just want to see this. And it was funny. I was watching like the commercials that they had in there and stuff like that. And it was very stereotypical of the content of that era. There was some of that. There was some other goofy stuff that was going on. But I think that there's like every era, whether it's say 95 to 2000, you break it down almost in 5-year chunks where you go, man, that fits that mold. And then the funny part is I see creators that are probably, say, your age, my age, you know, and they're from those eras. And here they are in 2026 and they're producing content still of like 2001 era type of format. And I'm like, dude, Jackie Bushman was doing that stuff like 25 years ago. Like, why not change? But yeah, to your point, it's hilarious when you look at that and you see what's trendy. And again, that's why when a lot of times when I produce videos, I try and find, you know, outside influence. It's funny, a few years ago, I'm going to go back probably about 7 or 8 years ago when Casey Neistat was real big doing his, he did daily vlogs on YouTube for, I don't know, like 800 and some days in a row or something like that. He lives in New York City. He probably hates us hunters. Probably does. I don't know. But I started doing content that was Casey Neistat inspired. Like, you know, he always said, he's like, yeah, I don't know how to do graphics and After Effects or any of this other type of program. So he literally takes out a piece of paper and a black marker and he like draws on it. And he's like this and that. So I started doing content like that. And it got a lot of footage because it was different. Nobody was doing that. But I was like looking for that type of inspiration. But what you find is you can only do that for so long. And then you've got to switch. You got to change.
Yeah.
Because if you keep with the same type of format, if you stuck with the heavy metal format like that, it's like, no, that doesn't work. Well, I did years ago, this has been probably 8 or 9 or 10 years ago for Magnus, we did these blood trail videos. So we would either, when somebody would shoot a deer, it was a pro staffer or somebody, we'd be like, hey, take out your phone and, film the blood trail. We want to see the blood trail. Everybody wants to know how much blood, you know, goes on the ground. And so I set it to this like creepy, like kind of hardcore music, kind of a like real dark. And I did a whole series of these. And here, just like, I want to say 6 months ago, I noticed somebody made a comment. The music on this is absolutely terrible. Blah, 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 blah. You ruined this. I'm like, dude, you just commented on a video that's like 8 years old. Like, we don't even do that anymore. So, So, to your whole point, it's all trends and you just go with the flow. And,
Then I think from metal, it went to like hardcore country.
Oh, yeah.
Where it wasn't like, I mean, it was almost like it went to, I'm trying to think of who would be a good representation of it, but it went from like this heavy metal to almost like this God, freedom, you know, like the perfect family type of country where it's like, if you love the United States, you got to thank God for your wife. Yeah. And it was just like this pride type country. It went into that for a while. And then, And I'll say one of the, and I'm searching for the word here, and maybe you can help me find it. When Heartland Bowhunter came out, and they would do a lot of this really fantastic B-roll, and in the B-roll, it had this like, what's the B-roll music? What's that called? Like a vibe. There was no words to it. It was like emotional and nature-esque and, God, there's a word.
I know what you mean. I don't know what the technical term for is it, but you're trying to set kind of that tone to
like relaxing and just like, and then maybe they crank it up a little
cinematic.
Bit. Yeah, cinematic and I love that. But I will say this, that in the era of content creation right now, the guys who put in the most work to match the audio with the video and are doing the most cinematic things, that really have like the editing budget and things like that. I really like what's going on today where the music and the visual are like, this is fun, right? I never really got that vibe from the metal era. I never really got that vibe from the country era. I never really got that vibe from that cinematic era. But right now, I think, and especially in the younger generation, they are making hunting seem really, really fun. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, some of that comes out of this younger generation, and this is a great topic here, is they come out of this, the TikTok and Reels type of era where everything is short and fast paced, bang, bang, bang.
Yep.
And this is a discussion that I've been having for years with content creators is they camp out. Many of them camp out on footage for way too long. So let's say, for example, you're hunting a field turkey and you've got him on video 100 yards away from you and he comes strutting on in all the way to your setup.
20 minutes worth of video.
Right. Yeah. And it's amazing. It's beautiful. He's gobbling. He's strutting. He turns and the sunlight hits through his fan and it's all beautiful. Here's the deal. It's only beautiful to you. You were the only person to live that. Nobody else gives a shit about watching 20 minutes of this bird coming across the field. And I say that with all due respect to everyone. And I catch myself doing it too. I've submitted films to people that I know and say, hey, critique this. And they're like, dude, you camped out on this scene too long. You got to cut. You got to do this. You got to do that. And if you watch an engaging TV show, if you watch an engaging commercial on television, what you're going to find is cameras cut way more than you ever thought they did. Unless it's just a long, serious dialogue scene in a some sort of TV drama or something like that, they cut. And what happens is your brain really only has about a 3 to 4 second attention span. After that, you get lost. Well, these younger people who are editing realize that from TikTok and from Reels and everything. Everything is bang, 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 bang. It'll be 7 years, I think, this summer. I started a series on my YouTube channel called S and S in 60. What it means is Saturday and Sunday in 60 seconds. This was before Reels or Shorts and all that stuff. And I really did it just to drive my creative juices. And it's telling a story over every 2-day weekend. I've done it for 7 years now, every weekend, of how to tell a story over 2 days in 60 seconds. And what it taught me was how to tell a story very quickly without dialogue and fast cuts, like 1 second, 12 frames. So that's a half a second worth of. And bang, bang, bang. It's very visually engaging. Some are way more interesting than others. Some suck. But anyways, the point being is, if you learn to tell a hunting story that way, it's so much more engaging. And that's where having the ability to have multiple camera angles, whether it's having, you know, your main cam and then having another B cam that's a mirrorless, or even now with action cameras the way they are. But being able to cut from bang to bang to bang to bang, it tells a story that's so much more engaging as you and a viewer. And then if you set it to music and you cut the video clips to the music, which now there's all kinds of tools that make it so much easier than doing it with your ear, the brain and the brain, ear, and eye experience, that combination that you get as a viewer, it makes it so much more engaging, just like you're talking about.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about that, to be honest with you. And it kind of goes back to the days where remember the VHSs, the VHS tapes that were like 40 kills in 50 minutes, you know, it's just like, holy shit, where some guy is just like, all right, today I'm here at this outfitter and we're going to get to work. And then they climb into a tree and then, they show a small buck walk by that they pass the next thing, you know, and it's like, this 3-minute hunt smokes a monster, and it literally is a cookie cutter template where it's show up, climb in a tree stand, spray your boots down with your product, cut away to all your sponsors, pass a small deer, giant steps out, shoot it, follow the blood trail. Do your trophy, you know, your hero shot, thank the outfitter, and then it's on to the next one.
Yeah.
And then we went through that era of these longer stories where there was way more detail into the storytelling, which I appreciate. And now, because of how social media works, we are slowly going back to the money shot. I'll just call it the quote unquote money shot. And yes, I do think you can st- still sometimes tell a quick, you know, a cool story about something in 60 seconds. But here's my issue. And maybe it's because I'm connected to this differently than other people, but I feel like sometimes all of the energy is around the kill still.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And it almost makes it seem like it's throwaway in my eyes, where it's just like, blah, 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 killed the animal, blah, 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 we're out. You know, like, and I feel like there is still, and I think it's because I'm getting older. I think it's because of how hunting impacted my life. That's probably different than a lot of other people and what their experience with hunting is. And I feel like there's still sometimes a lack of respect given to the animal
that
died for you to create said content. And I have a little bit of a problem with that.
No, you're totally right. You're totally right. And you're right. I've seen those. Heck, I've done them because, you know, 15 head chops in 20 seconds with turkeys or whatever. And I can't stand those really. But what I'm talking about is, like, for example, I did a video on my Africa hunt that was like 50 some minutes long. Yeah. And I came back from Africa with like 2 terabytes of video footage. I mean, it was an insane amount of footage. And I came back with that knowing that while there was going to be dialogue in the whole thing and there were going to be some longer scenes, that I needed a lot of extra footage to layer over it. Because to me, there's nothing I love hearing about. Like if you were going to film yourself hunting a deer, for example, I want to hear the 2 minutes of you telling what's going on leading up to it, or however you're going to tell that story, because most of the times we do need a narrative to do that. But you need a lot of supporting footage to layer over that, because I just don't want to look at, as pretty as you are, Dan, I don't want to look at your face for 2 minutes straight just talking to the camera if I don't have to. And so there's an ability there to tell a story with video footage and then complement it with the dialogue the narrative that goes along with it. So you got to find that combination and that balance. But the point is, a lot of these younger hunters or these younger producers, they've learned from this how to tell a story quickly and how to have a lot of other footage to support it. And they can come up with some very engaging edits, you know, that's going on. Yep. But, you know, I mean, when I do an edit, I try not to have that. Like, I'm in a tree for like 2 minutes of the camera just staring at me. And I'm like, well, okay, here we are. We're in southern Indiana. We got a northwest wind and it's this degrees and we got this and I'm sitting on that. And if you do tell that, it's like you better have some footage that backs all that up. Like if it's really windy that day, then when you're talking about the wind, cut to 3 seconds of, you know, the tree or the leaves blowing here and 3 seconds of grass blowing there. It just really engages the viewer, in that. But that takes a lot of work to do that. And there's a lot of people that don't want to put in the work. And there's some people that don't want to watch that type of stuff either. I mean, I've got friends of mine. They're like, dude, I don't want to see any of that crap. Just get to the chase. I want to see you kill the deer and that's it. I'm like, all right, whatever.
I want to see the giant walk through the woods and you put an arrow through his vitals. Yep. Yep, yeah, I get that.
But you're not going to see a giant walk through the woods on my videos. I'm the king. I'm the king of 130s when it comes to deer. So anyways.
Dude, I'm to the point in my life where I'll shoot a 130 every year, dude. I don't give a shit anymore.
I love it. I mean, right behind me, I've got, there's 9 of them. No, 10 right here behind me. And I'm looking at a whole nother wall of 130s and 140s. So yeah.
Right. So you've been kind of involved with some of the marketing, of certain products and brands throughout the course of your career. Even, you know, I think the earliest year I heard you was like 2009 or something like that.
Yeah. That's when I really got in. Yeah.
Yeah. In your opinion, how has marketing the hunting industry changed from 2009 to 2026?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is the transition from, you know, outdoor television and magazines to social media. I mean, you know, I look at the brands that I work with now and, you know, One does one TV show, but the rest, none of them do any TV shows. There, I can't tell you the last time that I opened a print hunting magazine, even myself, as much as that's sad to say, because I do miss the nostalgia of that. But everything now is social media. And what sucks about that is the shelf life is so short, meaning right. that I could,
you have
I
to
could,
continuously create things all the time.
It's constant. It's constant. Yeah. And I mean, for Magnus, I manage our social media and our pro staff and stuff like that, along with all my other duties. And I mean, I have to come up with 2 to 3 posts a week. Now in deer season, it's kind of easy because Joe Smith sends a picture of a nice buck he killed with it. And you're like, hey, Joe Smith in Iowa killed this, blah, blah, blah. That's pretty easy. Everybody likes the grip and grins. But the rest of the year, and you can only go so far with that, the rest of the year, you got to have engaging content. Mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, we make a sharp, pointy triangle. How many different photographs can I take of that? So you got to start getting creative. And yeah, it's exhausting. The shelf life is very short. I can do a video for whatever brand on a product or a product line, and it's awesome. You get tons of engagement. Like, hey, thanks. You answered some technical questions. This is great. And then 2 weeks later, hey, how do you do this with this broadhead or with this clothing or what? And you're like, I just freaking did a video on this. But the shelf life is so short. It's exhausting. It really is. And people don't understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it's crazy. It's not that way anymore, but I can remember trying to find partners or advertisers for the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. And so this was, you know, when I started the Nine Finger Chronicles 10 years ago. So like between 10 and 7 years ago, I can remember going to the ATA show and being like, hey, listen, I have this following that I've created and I got quite a few people, you know, like, you know, I got X number of people following me every week and they're listening to this and they're like, what's a podcast? At the time, a lot of the people who were in charge of the marketing dollars, it was like, well, I only know one thing, and that's to give it to print ads, give it to North American Whitetail, give it to Outdoor Life, whatever, put it in magazines and TV shows. And a lot of those guys now are gone because they retired. And now you see the marketing change with all of these younger people and or media companies, like they're outsourcing their marketing budgets to people who are younger and know how to do the social media and know how to do the digital aspect of it. And so I've noticed that big change as well. And so it's like, it's always changing and always evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I remember, you know, everybody had a media kit back in the day. If you remember that, they had folders. They'd come in with this, folder and it'd be bound and they'd flip through and all this. And yeah, now it's totally changed and it's totally different. And in some ways, it can be a little more difficult weeding through the legit stuff from the BS stuff, to be quite frank. Oh, yeah. I mean, I know, you know, coming off of this past ATA show, we had several, we being at Magnus, we had several discussions of, you know, hey, you know, so-and-so approached me and said he knows so-and-so and this and that. And my BS meter goes off pretty quick with a lot of people. And so I just like, hey, okay, give me all the information, all the stuff, and I will go down the rabbit hole. And I can fairly quickly figure out who's full of it and who's legit, you know, but it's totally different now. Who's hot today may not be hot 6 months from now. And, you know, everybody's full of promises and seldom do they deliver. It's so aggravating and frustrating, you know? So it's changed. You know, I hate to sound like a grumpy older guy, but you know, I mean, sometimes I miss the way things that were done, but then again, you just got to go with the flow and accept it and make the best of it and figure it out. I guess in some ways it kind of keeps me young and, you know, I'm not quite the grumpy old man that my kids think I am, but.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is the direction of like how entwined the hunting community is into the hunting industry. All right. And the impact that those have on each other. 20 years ago, and I've mentioned this a lot of times, 20 years ago, I could go knock on a door in the county that I used to live in. And I'm like 80% getting permission on that piece.
Yeah.
Right. Like, hey, dude, in 2000, and let's say it's in 2006, I knocked on a lot of doors, and unless there was a serious family hunting it, I was getting on that farm. Mm-hmm. Like, it was easy. Now the cost of deer hunting is up. And what I mean by that is, not only is it up, you know, obviously the cost of the products, the cost of the bows, the cost of the guns and things like that are up, but the cost of access is also up, just like, especially in the state of Iowa. How have you seen that impact, you know, with what you're doing in the kind of the marketing side of this? You know, you're trying to market people to get, hey, eyes on a specific brand. But at the same time, I just feel like there is, it's becoming harder for people. Let me see if I can rephrase this. The hunting industry wants people to buy products. However, the direction that the hunting community is going, it is becoming harder for people to find access to hunt. Therefore, they are not spending as much money in the space. And so it's almost like, I almost feel like the hunting industry is a bubble, and it's about to pop, because access is becoming harder and harder to find.
Yes. Yes. And this is, man, there's so many layers to this onion that you can peel back here. The bubble, it's funny you mentioned that, because I've been saying that a lot lately, especially in the mobile hunting space. Throw a shout out here to the guys who run the Mobile Hunter Expo. I met those guys years ago and have been very involved with them. And so they do these Mobile Hunter Expos a couple of year, one in Dalton, Georgia, and one in Southern Ohio. And what I've seen in that space in particular is, and I keep saying this, I've had so many conversations about that, there's a bubble there that's going to burst, because everybody floods in and there's only so much money to go around. And to your point, hunting in general and trying to hunt places is so expensive that something has to give. And I think it also applies to the hunting industry in general. And we've had discussions about this, me and, you know, the various brands and partners I work with, about all that. And it's like, at some point, something has to give. And everybody says it's becoming a rich man's sport, and it is, sadly. And I think that's part of the reason you're seeing such a push on public land. You know, we all know what that is these days. And I hate that now has created a rift in the hunting community. You're either a public land hunter or you're a private land hunter, and you're a rich private land hunter if you own land. If you're a public land hunter, you're a Billy Badass. You're more badass than anybody else. And I absolutely hate that, because I disagree on all accounts of that. However, to your point, it all just feels like it's just like this huge weight that looms over all of us. And I don't know where it really goes from here. And I even see it in my own world from the standpoint that I happen to own some land. I bought it about 18 years ago. And on this country block that I bought, there was hardly anybody that deer hunted at the time. If they did, they went out in gun season. Nobody turkey hunted it.
Yeah.
Now, our turkey season opens a week from today. I guarantee there will be a turkey hunter on every chunk of property on this block. Yeah. And it's totally changed. I had a young man, I say young, he's probably in his mid-20s, come up to knocking on my door this past fall. And I'm glad he did. I mean, kudos to him. He shot a doe on a neighboring piece of property, came onto my property. He came up to the house. Hey, I shot a doe. She died on your property. I'm like, you know where she, he's like, yeah, if we walk around the corner, we can probably see her laying out in the field. I'm like, okay. So we start talking a little bit, and he goes, I go, where'd you lease? And he tells me, it's just a giant field that happens to have like a row of trees that's not 10 yards wide. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm like, you leased that? It's like 80 some acres. And he goes, yeah. And he even told me what he paid. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. He goes, well, he goes, I got to be honest with you. He said, one of the reasons I leased it, he goes, I was looking at property records and I saw you own the property next to it. And he goes, I know who you are. And he goes, I know you always kill big deer. So I knew I had a chance to kill a big deer. I can't be freaking kidding me. I mean, this is, that's the way the whole thing goes. I'm like, I mean, I don't kill big deer again. I joke, I'm the king of 130s, but you know, I mean, in 18 years, I've killed 240 inch deer off of this property. It's not like they're giants, but still the point is that we see it from all different angles and I don't know where it goes. I don't think it's healthy and I hate to see companies go under and people get out of the sport, but I almost wonder if we haven't created a monster that we just don't even know how to control. And ultimately, you know, the 3 R's program and all this. And I've introduced so many kids over the years to hunting and archery and, you know, all that stuff. And I go, man, I want to see hunting continue on. But then there's a selfish side of you that goes, holy crap, what have we done here? And at some point, something's going to give. And I don't think it's going to be pretty. And I don't know what it's going to look like, but, you know.
I'm going to voice my opinion right now, and I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. But you have these people, call them influencers, call them landowners, call them people who are managing for older age class. And what I mean by that is, you can enter that into any state. You can say Iowa, you can say Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, wherever. They are buying land or leasing ground or whatever the case is for one goal, and that is to manage a whitetail herd to get it to an older age class so that hopefully there is a bigger buck on that farm so that they can shoot it, right? And these people seem to be the most vocal about how shitty the rules and regulations are in every state. Oh my God, there's no 150s anymore. It's hard to find a 140 or this or that. Okay. Meanwhile, there's a giant group of people out there who just want to hunt, right? And so I don't know where this balance is, where you have, I'll just say this. I was following it really closely for a while. I haven't been following it, closely recently, but the state of Michigan seems to be torn in two. A lot of these guys are like, hey, we want to make it a one buck state, all this shit. And then you got another group of people who are like, dude, we are completely happy with the baiting. We're happy with the smaller deer. We just want the opportunity to shoot something. And I think that sentiment is exposed in the state of Michigan, but it's also happening in every other state where there's people with bigger platforms, you know, saying like, well, I want big giant antlers. That's what I'm looking for. Why aren't there any 5-year-olds anymore? And I look at that and I go, that's fucking arrogant to think that you deserve a 5-year-old buck every single year compared to the guy down the road who maybe shares permission on 80 acres with 3 other bow hunters, 4 other bow hunters, a shotgun group goes through there. There's a turkey guy through there, you know, every single year. And they just want to see a 120 or a 100-inch deer, depending on where you're at, right? It's all relative to where you're at and the population of the state. And I look at that and I'm just like, how do you balance that? Because I know plenty of guys who just want to get out and hunt. They want to forget about their 40-hour-a-week job. They want to, you know, like, dude, this is the only time in my entire year where I get to step outside and just forget about life at the moment. I want to put some meat in the freezer. I want to make deer sticks so that I can bring them to tailgating and eat it throughout the summer. I don't give a shit about, you know, planting food plots and hinge cutting and all this stuff. It just seems this point where there's this big divide. And the people who have the biggest exposure, like the biggest platforms, have self-interest in mind as opposed for what is better for the hunting community. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
No, I totally agree. I hear it all the time. And I agree with you. I don't know the answer either. And all I can say is that I live in Indiana. So we're now a one buck state. We've been a one buck state for, I don't know, 20 some odd years or whatever it's been. We were a two buck state like Michigan. I live about 20 miles roughly south of the Michigan line. So, you know, I feel a connection to Michigan. I'm actually going up there this weekend to turkey hunt. But yeah, so what they're going through, we lived through it in Indiana as well. And I remember it really divided our state. Still, I mean, still there's some people that are very bitter about it. Did it make a difference in the end? Bigger bucks? I don't know. I want to say yes, yes and no. I think generally, yes, we do produce a few more mature bucks than what we used to. You still get a lot of guys are just, they're browning down, and that's cool. I joke that I live in the browning down county in the state. I live in Steuben County. We lead the state every year in deer harvest. We are the number one, on the rare occasion, number two in deer harvest in the state of Indiana every year. And we are the browning down capital of the state. But yet there are still some big deer that get produced, but it causes a riff. I listen to, because I do own my own land here. I own some land in southern Indiana as well. So I do food plots and stuff like that. So I tend to listen to various podcasts that revolve around that, because I don't really relate to the, as much as I respect the people that are badasses that run up and down the hills on public land and kayak in miles to get a deer. I mean, God, that's amazing. But I don't relate to that hunter because it's not what I do. So I listen to these podcasts about private land owners and food plots because I can relate to it. And they all spiral down to that rabbit hole. What you're saying is, well, I'm trying to grow a 5.5 or a 6.5 year old buck and all this. And I go, God, is it really to this point? You know, and I love it so much when my daughter, Sydney, who's 25 and or will be 25 this summer, and she goes to Iowa State out there, and she comes home and she hunts with me once or twice every fall. And she loves to bow hunt, and she will not pick up a gun to hunt. And to me, it's so refreshing when she does, because the girl doesn't know what inches of antler are. She just wants to kill a deer. You know, I mean, yeah, she knows what a little four corn or a little basket rack is, and she'd love to kill, you know, oh my God, if she shot 130 inch deer, I mean, she'd be to the moon and back. And that's so refreshing, because to me, it reminds me of what hunting in some ways used to be. And I know there reaches a point in our lives where you do want to kill a bigger deer or a mature deer. I mean, I'm not going to go out and shoot a four corn buck or something like that, you know, but I want to shoot, you know, I want to shoot a mature buck. I'll let you define whatever that is. I mean, probably to me, some people don't think what I shoot is mature. And I'm like, that's fine. I know where I live, and I know the inventory of deer that live here. And so I know what I'm killing. And if that doesn't live up to your standards, quite frankly, I don't give a shit. You know, right. I mean, this is for me. So yeah, I don't know. I hate it. Again, it's these divides in the hunting space that we all fight. I think we're our own worst enemies. Again, where it comes to public land versus private, or mature deer versus not, or one buck versus two buck, or crossbow versus regular bow. Insert whatever freaking topic you want. We're our own worst enemies. And I don't know, but at some point the bubble's going to burst and it's going to be ugly. And I don't know where hunting, when it all comes crumbling down and the pieces are laying on the table, I don't know how hunting picks itself up and where it goes from there, because something has to give. I can't believe that this insanity can continue. But then I look at the overall world and all the other bullshit that goes on in the world and go, well, shit. Not to be political, but we're in continued forever wars where the economy's up, and for some people they feel like they're poor. And I'm like, where the hell does all this end? Because it's just insanity, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. And this is a point of contention. And I'm just going to be completely honest here. It's a point of contention financially in my family. And I do this for a living. And even though I do this for a living, I spend, I don't know, let's just say $1,200 to go to South Dakota every year. That includes tag, that includes gas, that includes, a cabin that I rent with another guy, and there's no running water. Like this is bare minimum campground cabin. I go out there and I have an absolute blast. I get to do this for a living. It helps me generate content for everything that I do, social media, this and that. and it's still $1,200 mm-hmm. that I'm not giving to my family.
Yep.
And so I look at it as an expense, but at the same time, I got, my wife doesn't necessarily feel that same way about yeah. that. It's like, well, what about the family? Why aren't, you know, what about $1,200 for a vacation or $1,200 for something else around like a remodeling project? This bathroom here needs to be fixed up or something like that. And that's like the state of the world, right? It's mm-hmm. just like, dude, there's, I don't know, dude, like.
No, I feel it, man. I
don't know.
And
I don't want to get political, but this fucking world is in a tornado right now.
It is. It is. And to circle back to what you're, yeah, oh God, dude, I could go down a rabbit hole about this world and everything right now, but to circle back on the cost of what you're saying is, and it's all scalable. Okay. It's like, oh my God, the first world problems. And so people will look at,
you know, I have to remind myself that for this first world shit.
Right.
I have to remind myself.
And here's what you have to look at. So you have to look at that there are hunters out there that just what you just said, it's like, holy shit, Dan can spend $1,200 to go out of state and hunt. Boy, that must be freaking nice. Exactly. Yeah, the whole must be nice crowd. Now here's what I look at it as. Dan and Guy go, at $1,200 means like a cheap out of state experience. I just went to South Africa last summer and spent $12,000, and I'm preparing for my next one in a couple of years where I may spend $20,000 on that one. And you might go, holy shit, Derek Craig can spend $12,000 on that. It must be nice. It's all scalable because I can look up the ladder and go, shit, man, it must be nice to be Mark Drury and have, you know, a gazillion acres and giant bucks. It's all scalable. At the end of the day, we're all doing the same thing. And yeah, if I spend $12,000 to go to Africa to go hunt with, and my wife's going, well, what the hell? Why can't we spend $12,000 on getting our driveway paved? We've got a quarter mile long driveway at our house. I know, again, first world problems. I totally get it. But why do we have to live with a gravel driveway? Why can't we upgrade that? Or why can't we do, you know, whatever? And so there's always this balance and it's all scalable. So anybody who sits there and looks at, well, it must be nice to be Dan Johnson or Derek Craig or Mark Drury or whoever, you know, they probably have somebody below them that goes, man, it must be nice to be Bill Smith. He can afford to spend $200, you know, to go up to Michigan for a weekend to go hunt turkeys, you know? So, you know, I don't really know where I go with this, but yeah, it you do take away from what you're doing. And, you know, the money is important, whether you've got kids or, again, I've got adult age kids. So, I mean, I don't think the financial part of raising kids ever goes away, but anyways, it's all sacrifices and give and take. And again, at some point in time, man, it feels like this house of cards is just going to come crumbling down, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm afraid of it for one reason only. And that is, where is my boy going to hunt?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
in 10 years, what's my boy going to do?
I have that
only. I don't know, man.
I had that same fear about Sydney. Now, again, both of my daughters hunted. My oldest, she doesn't hunt anymore. It was dad-daughter time. She loves it. But Sydney loves to bow hunt. And I mean, I look at her you know who Caitlin Mouse is? So Caitlin, she's in her late 20s, young lady, and she's out there grinding on public. And I go, you know, here's a young lady who's out here getting it done. I know she's got some private. And I look at Sydney, I go, you could follow like what this girl's doing. But then I go, man, it's for a young lady like her to go out and battle on public land in Iowa. I'm like, I can't even imagine that looks like standing at the base of Mount Everest going, how the hell am I going to survive this journey up, you know? And then I sit there and go, how in the hell is Sydney going to be able to afford someday to be able to have a lease to go hunt somewhere in whatever state she lives in? And I mean, she can always come back here and hunt, you know, my little 80 acres that I own at my house, but you know, how's she going to broaden her horizons? And I don't know, man. I mean, maybe our parents said the same thing about us in whatever aspect of life it is, and we just figured it the hell out. I don't know. Maybe they will as well, and maybe your son will as well. But yeah, as a parent, you really worry about that, is where does it go for those young kids who want to do this? And I'm sure they'll figure it out, and we're probably worrying about shit that probably really doesn't matter in the overall scope of things. You know, maybe they go to hell with it and I'm just done. And if they do, that's sad. You know, I don't know.
this is going to sound pretty horrible, and I hope it doesn't come off as bad as it's going to sound, but there's a part of me that wishes for some kind of maybe claps. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then it gets restructured.
Yeah.
Coming out of this total destruction of something always seems to come something more or better than what it was. And it takes a crash. I don't know if that's land prices, if that's the industry, if that's, conservation or whatever the case is, but something bad happens. Then we have a purge of sorts. And then all of a sudden out of that comes a better time.
Yeah. And I think we all probably have selfishly thought something like that. And you go, man, but do I really want that to happen? You know, but I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what it's, what it's going to look like, but I think it's going to take a reset button on hunting to get things cleaned up. And maybe on the,
hopefully we're in control of that.
Yeah.
That's all we kind of hope for.
And the sad part is on the flip side, it could look worse than what it, you don't know. That's the problem. No. But I just can't see it maintaining what it's doing. I don't know. And I hate to be a downer like that, but I don't know. All I know is, you know what? I'm just going to keep enjoying going, on the properties I got and the opportunities I have. I mean, I'm looking forward this weekend. I'm going up to Michigan with a buddy of mine who's about 10 years older than me. His hips are destroyed. He had hip replacement surgery. He's just like, he was telling me, he might have some cancer issues going on. And I go, you know what? I'm just going to go up and I'm going to spend the weekend and hunting with him. And I'm just going to enjoy hunting with a friend of mine because I don't know how much longer I have to. I had a good friend of mine who was about 10 years older than me pass away last June. And I was like, shit, I thought we'd have more time to hunt together. And so I'm just looking at it going, we can sit here and worry about all this and stress about it. But at the end of the day, I'm going to walk back here in my woods and I'm going to shimmy my ass up a tree and wait for a deer to walk by. And I'm going to put an arrow through his lungs. And that's, and that's all I can do. That's all I can do, and that's it, That's all you can do. So,
I want to do a hard pivot real quick. In 2 weeks, 2 weeks. I will hit 1 year of zero alcohol.
Hell yes, buddy.
Yep. And I feel really good about that decision.
Good for you.
Talk to me a little bit about, because that was part of the message that you emailed me about, kind of your journey with alcohol. Walk me through that once.
Yeah. So, again, being 56, you reflect back on your life and, I probably started drinking like fun parties when I was about 17, 18 years old, drinking beer and stuff like that. And, I have a friend of mine, good friend. He goes, Derek, listen, he used to joke about this when we were in our 20s. If you think you got a problem, you probably got a problem type of thing, And we always joked about it. So anyways, you go through life and, I just like beer. God, do I like beer? Or an old fashioned or whatever. And, doing the thing, whether it's business or going out with friends. I was never a bar scene person, never liked going to bars, but just like to drink with friends and go out and have a good time and go to dinner and have a couple drinks, three drinks, four drinks, whatever, and all that shit. And can guarantee say to this day, I was not and am not and never was an alcoholic. I mean, I guess they say you can't not be. I mean, if you are one, you are one for life. Not an alcoholic at all.
Yeah.
But I like beer. Straight up, dude. I mean, you give me a 12-pack of beer and I could sit here and just from now till 5 o'clock and it be gone and be still functioning. And I like beer. I like drink. I like the social lubricant that alcohol is and was in my life. And the thing is, I had toyed with this for years. I know I'm putting a poison in me. I know I feel like shit the next day. Like, why are you doing this? And like, so I'd take like 2 months and be like, I'm not going to drink for a month or two. I'm just not. And you know, I have to admit, like about a year ago, listening to some of your content, I heard you say, yeah, you were done drinking. And, you know, you sit here and you keep self-reflecting and you go back and forth about this. Like, do you want, really want to drink? Don't you want to drink? I know Rogan talked about it for a while. He took like 9 months or something. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to drink. And you listen to people. And I reached a point where I was like, dude, you're 56. This was a real conversation I had with myself in my head last summer. Like, you're 56 and you're drinking beer like you're 26. Like, what the hell is the point in this? And the problem is, A, I like drinking beer. I love the taste of beer. I love quality beers. You know, I mean, I'll drink a Coors Light or a Busch Light or whatever. But I mean, I like a craft beer, you know. I really like hazy IPAs. I love the flavor, you know, and all that stuff. And I'm like, why are you doing this? Because I could drink. I'm not kidding you, man. I could sit here on a Saturday and Sunday and burn through a case of beer and never really get drunk, you know, over the course of a day. And the problem is you wake up the next morning and you still have a hangover. You're like, I wasn't drunk. But your body's got to process that. And I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? You feel like shit in the mornings. You're lethargic. You know, you don't want to get out of bed. And I was like, self, this is dumb. You are a grown ass man. There's no need for this. And so on September, the last day of September, September 30th, I don't remember how many days are in September. Opening day of deer season is October 1. I had like three beers left in the refrigerator. And I told my wife, I said, I'm drinking these three beers tonight. And that's it. She's like, are you serious? I'm like, yep. And so, yeah, since October 1, so it's just been a hair over 6 months. I have not had any alcohol whatsoever. Well, I say that, but the caveat that what I found is I do like NA beers. Now, you can say NA beers can have up to 0.5% alcohol. So you would have to drink basically a 12-pack to get the alcohol content out of one beer. Okay. So I do that. And I like that because I like the taste of beer. Okay. So it's not about the alcohol. And some NAs, I think like Heineken Zero is zero. So I said, the hell with it. I'm just done. And I feel better about myself. And another big inspiration was, and I mentioned them earlier, the guys at the Mobile Hunter Expo, I hang out with them at their two shows in the summers and we're all drinking and stuff. And there's two guys that work in the crew with us and they're probably, I'm going to say early to mid 30s. And we're drinking one night. I see them drinking these NA Blue Moons. I'm like, why are you guys drinking? Like, we're all just sitting around drinking like beers, you know? I mean, I've got some Coors Lights and other guys got garage beers and we're drinking and we're having fun. And they're like, yeah, just don't drink. I'm like, what the hell? Like, and they're like, Derek, we have so much fun still. We get to be a part of it and we just don't drink alcohol and we don't have to worry about getting a DUI. And, you know, I mean, when we go home from the restaurant tonight, guess what? Give me the keys to your truck. Even though you've only had three beers or something, give me the keys to your truck and I'll drive us back. And then there's no issues. I'm like, and so the more we talked, I was like, you know what? If these guys can do that and fit in with the group, nobody in the group of 15 or 20 or more of us gave a shit that these two guys weren't drinking real beer. They're drinking NA beers. I'm like, I think I can do this. So I did it. Told both of them at ATA. I ran into both of them at ATA and they're like, dude, that's so awesome. And we text, now it's funny, we text pictures like, hey, have you tried this NA beer or something like that? Or here's a good one to try. You know, if you just enjoy the taste of beer. And so, yeah, it's been awesome. It's been an awesome journey. It has not been difficult. So I know I wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, it was just like, boom. I mean, outside the fact, it's like until I discovered some quality NA beers to have with a steak dinner. I like a quality beer with a steak dinner. It's like, you know, it's no big deal. Honestly, the worst part was I've got some really close friends of mine I do a lot with, and they're very supportive, but they still to this day don't understand it. They're like, dude, we've known you since high school. Like, what the hell? I'm like, I just don't want to, man. I just don't want to. It's been a fun journey. I feel better about myself. I like the fact that now when my wife and I go out to dinner, my wife loves wine. So she can have two or three glasses of wine. I didn't drink anything. We don't have to have this discussion of, hey, who's driving us home? You know, and also too, as you go over the years, not that I mean, hey, we've all had too much drink and drive, and technically you shouldn't even have one beer and drive. But the point being is at some point in time, the luck's going to run out. And quite frankly, I have too much in my life, especially financially, to lose. to fuck it all up because I drank three beers and got pulled over and, you know, and all that. So there's that. There's feeling better about it. You know, feeling better about yourself physically. Not only physically do I feel better, but mentally I feel better about myself. It's engaging. You know, another thing is, man, the more we drink, the more chance of stupid shit coming out of your mouth. And I say enough stupid shit stone cold sober that I really don't need, you know. And I'm just at that point. And dude, it's been I was listening to one of your recent podcasts. You were talking about that, and I can't remember if you were talking about kind of the challenges of it, and it's not without its challenges, is obviously. And I was like, man, I'm gonna reach out to Dan and say, hey brother, like I'm doing this too. And in some ways, Dan, to be quite honest, you were a little bit of an inspiration for that, because I'd heard you talk about it. I'd heard Rogan talk about it. I'd heard others talk about it. I had debated this for it with myself internally in my head for several years. Do I want to do this? And the biggest struggle was, how do you handle it in the social circles? You know, when we're at ATA, for example, and we all go out to St. Elmo's and we have a nice steak dinner and everybody's ordering old fashions, like, how are you going to be that guy? And, or everybody goes back to the hotel bar afterwards and hangs out. Like, are you going to be that guy that just drinks a Diet Coke or a club soda or a water or something? And what I found was nobody gives a shit.
Nobody.
That's a beauty. They really don't give a shit. And it's all in your own head that you're like, oh shit, I'm not going to fit in.
Right.
I'm not going to fit in, you know?
Right.
And we just went, my wife and I just got back from Cancun. We went, we booked this before I quit drinking. That's the funny part. So we go with this group of friends of ours. We've all known each other since high school. And we go to an all-inclusive resort. So I've paid for it all. All the food, all the beverages you want to drink. Doesn't matter if it's water, soda, or beer, or hard liquor. You can drink whatever you want. And they're like, Derek, are you really going to do this? I said, guys, I'm going to really do this. I am. And I did it. We were in Cancun for four full days. And I never had a drop of alcohol. And I had a great time. And the funny part was, a couple of my buddies just got lit. I mean, it was hilarious. They were in the big community pool and got, you know, they're partying hard. And I'm just sitting back, just laughing, shaking my head. And I turned to my wife and go, God, was I all this loud and obnoxious when I'd get out of here? She's like, oh God, yes. I'm like, shit, I don't miss that, man. Looking from the outside in, I don't miss it at all. But so it's been a hell of a journey. It really has. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, there's a lot of... I keep running into reasons not to drink now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like at the beginning for me, it was extremely hard from a social standpoint. Also, I thought that in order for me to relax at the end of the day, I needed those three beers that turned into three bourbons on ice. You know what I mean? Like, in order for me to just even go to sleep at night, I had to unwind after the kids were in bed, and all that did was just make the next day harder and
that's
the next
how
day
I was
harder
every
and the next
day.
Day harder. Yep. Yep. And so, and then on the weekends, it's just like, okay, now I don't have anything going on tomorrow. I know I can drink one or two or three or four more beers or more bourbons. And then I had to wake up and be a parent.
Yeah.
And there's one thing that made me feel like a complete piece of shit, and that was trying to be a parent with a huge hangover. And your boy going, Dad, let's go play catch. And you're like, not right now, buddy. Dad's not feeling well. And they're like, why? And then as they get older, they start to see the connection. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that. I'm not like my dad. My dad could keep a six pack of beer in his refrigerator for 6 days, and he could have one beer a day after work, and that was it. He's really good at that.
Mine was similar. He wasn't a big drinker. He never really has been.
And mine was the complete opposite. It's there. Let's go. And I can remember a point, and this is probably one of those too much information things, where I would buy a bottle of Jack Daniels and I would start to drink it throughout the week, right? Mm-hmm. Sip on it. And this is probably too much information, but like there would be blood in my stool and it was a direct connection to how much I was drinking.
Yeah.
And I knew then where I was like, okay, this is obviously not good. I better switch to beer. Like that. What What a completely crazy thought process where you're like, oh, well, I'm drinking too much hard stuff. Better switch to beer. And that's going to fix any problems.
Yeah. I'm going to quit eating donuts and switch to just eating pancakes, you know?
Exactly. I mean, oh yeah. Whatever the case is.
Yeah.
And so it just became rough. And then my wife, she also struggled with it. And I think it hit us both at the same time. And we were just like, you know what? We don't need this. And I don't want my kids to see this anymore. And I'm hoping that now, like, I'm overkill. Like, I tell my daughter, who is now 13 years old, dude, I had my first sip of alcohol in seventh grade. My daughter is in seventh grade.
Yeah.
That's when I started drinking, was in seventh grade.
That's eye-opening as a parent. You're like, holy
exactly,
shit. Yeah.
Exactly. And so now I'm to the point where I'm just like, okay, I'm going to be completely blunt with her and truthful about it and just be like, hey, I did all of these things. And I'll tell you right now, there's nothing good. And I'm not saying alcohol is the devil.
Nope.
Right. But
it's wonderful.
what was the devil for me was my lack of moderation.
Yeah.
That was my problem. And I went the route of, instead of cutting back, I just cut it out altogether. And I think my life is better because of that.
No, I 100% agree with everything you just said there. It's kind of funny when you talk about your kids. So again, having adult age daughters, one of the coolest things about when your kids become adult age and they're in their 20s is you can actually sit down and have a beer with them or something like that. You know, and they're going to go through that. I mean, both of my daughters went through the same stuff that every, you know, most young adults do, is like they turn 18, 19, they go to college and they party and they do that and they end up facing the toilet. I mean, we've all been there before. Okay. Mm-hmm. But as then they grow, like my oldest daughter, she'll have an occasional glass of wine. She's really not a big drinker anymore. Just doesn't agree with her, but she'll have an occasional glass of wine. Now, Sydney, again, my youngest, my Hunter, she is a mini me. I joke that she's me with boobs. I mean, she loves beer. That girl loves beer, you know? And the funny part is, when I quit drinking and I was out there, I think I was on one of my trips out there to see her, or maybe she was coming home or something. I'm like, yeah, I'm just drinking these NAs. And she's like, let me try one of these, Dad. So then a few months go on and she sends me a text message. I think it was, and she goes, Dad, I just want you to know, I was out with some friends the other night, went to a bar, and she goes, I had like two regular beers and then I switched to NA beers. And you know what? Mm-hmm. She goes, I think that's going to be my call from now on, is just have one or two real beers with my friends and I'm going to switch to NAs. She's like, we're there for many hours. So by the time the one or two I've had, they've worked through my system. I still am drinking with my friends. I'm just having NA beers and I don't have a hangover. And then we were just out in Iowa here a couple weeks ago for her defense for her master's that she's going through. And we went to, I'm like, I want to go get to liquor store and get some NA beers. And I'm like, do you want anything? She goes, no, just get a few for me too. I'm like, you don't want real beer? She goes, no, Dad, I'm mostly drinking NAs for the most part now. She's like, I'll still have an occasional. So as a parent, when you see that, you're like, oh man,
that's a good thing.
They still pay attention, you know? And I don't want her to totally quit drinking alcohol, but I really respect that decision of her to be like, you know what? Getting drunk wasn't all that fun, Dad. I mean, I like maybe one or two, that little social lubricant, you know, it loosens you up a bit. And I want to continue to have that flavored beer, but I don't want to get drunk. So I can appreciate that. Another story, a friend of mine in the hunting space, we were traveling together. He's not a huge beer drinker, but he drinks a few. And we were on a recent trip to one of the deer classics. And he's like, I'm gonna get a six pack of beer. I'm like, well, I'll get a six pack of NAs. And so we get back to the hotel and he's like, can I try them? I'm like, sure, here, hell. He's like, damn, these are good. Next thing you know, after going on a couple of these trips, he goes, yeah, I think I'm just switching. He's like, there's no point. He goes, I don't need the alcohol. He sends me a little video clip on his phone here like a week or two ago. He's like, dude, just letting you know, I just picked up a case of the Coors. I haven't had it yet. The NA Coors is. He goes, this is just like Coors Banquet. It's like my favorite beer of all time. He goes, screw that. I'm drinking these from now on. So when you start seeing yourself spinning off and influencing others in that way, you go, okay, you know what? I think maybe I did make the right decision, not only for me, but what I project outward towards others. And I'll never hold it against anybody who drinks. Again, my good friends were in Cancun and they were living it up, dude, in their 50s, still living it up, partying hard like they were in their 20s. And that's awesome. But you know, on the last day when one of them could barely make it to the plane when we were coming home, I was like, hey, buddy, how you doing? I'm just sitting over here chilling, just feeling great about life. So it's been a great decision. And, you know, I mean, again, I do owe a little bit of it to you and some others as, you know, people out there doing it. And I'm hoping maybe, you know, this conversation to others go, shit, Dan's doing it. Yeah. Derek's doing it. Some others are doing it. Maybe I can do it, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yep. There's an initial stage where it's tough, but then every single month seems to be getting better to the point now where it's not even on my mind anymore.
It isn't.
The other thing I want to kind of, this is kind of a sidestep from the same conversation, and that would be the future. Like, I have kids. My kids are the most important thing. My wife and my kids are, you know, one and two in my life. My wife and my kids. And I'm going through this knee thing now. Mm-hmm. And I used to think that I had to go out for football when I was a kid. And I had to do all of this be hard on my body. And it cost me. I played rugby in college. I played football. They both cost me a knee when I was doing that. And I look at my sons right now and I go, that window for athletics is so small in the grand scheme of your total life that unless you are just on the brink of being some type of spectacular athlete that is going to make some kind of huge financial gains or maybe get your college paid for, I don't know. Like, if my boys don't want to do football, man, I'm okay with that. Like, I'm not going to push my kids into any type of sport where the outcome is a 45-year-old having a knee replacement surgery because he abused his body when he was younger. And I look at something like that, like, you know, I know some of my other friends who are in really good shape. They didn't necessarily do a ton of sports growing up. And they found like a really healthy workout routine, you know, as they got into their 30s and 40s and things like that. And I look at that now and I go, holy shit, dude. Like, if I could go back and tell myself, I probably would. I had a lot of fun playing football and had a lot of fun playing rugby. I would just be like, dude, be careful, because in 25 years, you're going to have a problem walking. You know what I mean? So that's not necessarily the case of athletics or alcohol or drugs or bad decisions, because in order to become a better person, you have to go through these hard times yourself. And you got to learn how to cope with whatever problems come your way. But as a parent, I feel like, for example, my dad never talk to me about how to be a good husband. You know what I mean? Like, you should try thinking about this, or, you know, do this. And so, you know, like most men, they have to find out, you know, the best ways to be a husband or a father the hard way. And I am not going to be like that. I will be the opposite of that. And I will be very vocal about here's what has worked and here's what has not worked for me. And not just about what I've mentioned, the alcohol, the relationships, about all things in life. Right. And I'll be like, I did this. You can try it. You're going to do what you're going to do. But here's where I've succeeded and failed in the past, in hopes that, there was a quote, the only man that wants to see you do better than them is your father. Right. Yeah. And that's the goal in my life, is to have my sons in some way, shape or form. And even my daughter be more successful than me in not just in business, but in life in general. And so, that's my goal, for the remainder of my life, is to prepare my children for the real world as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's always been my goal. as well. Whether it's, you know, setting them up for a career and whatever they wanted to do, you know, and providing them with hopefully some opportunities. I mean, not handing them opportunities, but obviously, you know, cracking open the door when it needed to, or just being their biggest cheerleader and telling, sometimes coaching them from the standpoint of, you know, hey, the decisions that you make impact things further than you can even imagine down the road.
Right.
Whether that's sports, and, you know, I had girls, so they played sports. Obviously football wasn't a thing for them. Although if Sydney could have, she would have laced them up and been out there with the guys playing football. But, there's so many other things that are so much more important in life, and being a good role model and good coach. And I'm not even really going to touch on my past relationship with, my dad in particular. But I will say that you can reflect back on the way you were raised, whether, and I think, well, I know this for a fact as a parent, that there are a lot of things that you're proud of that you do when you're raising your kids. And there's other things where you go, shit, God, I wish I could have done that 20 different ways better.
Yep.
Because at the end of the day, I have had this discussion. Now I joke with my girls about it, but it used to be a point of contention when they'd be pissed at me. I'd be like, I'm still looking for the damn owner's manual that was supposed to come with you because you didn't come with one, you know? And so I really don't know how to handle this situation. So to be quite frank, sometimes I'm going to win, I'm going to do well. And other times, quite bluntly, I'm going to fuck it up. So, you know, and so
there's no factory reset with parenting.
No, there's not. And now we joke about it. At the time they didn't think it was funny, but now we get into things you know, both of my girls are very, you know, they're very forward. They'll tell you what's on their mind, and they'll get it. They like to give me hell about stuff. And I'd be like, you know, I'm still looking for that damn owner's manual that was supposed to slide out when you slid out, and it never did. Yeah, so
never did.
But to your point, and I totally agree, is you need to be there as a parent, and you need to be a good role model, and you need to be a good cheerleader, but also you need to know when to just back up and just say, you know what? Because I think a very important lesson in life, as painful as it can be, whether it's getting injured, physically injured, mentally injured, financially injured, we all to some degree are 10 foot tall and bulletproof at some point in our life. And that's where you separate the wheat from the chaff. And that's where you grow in a positive way. That's where your mistakes that you make hopefully direct you in a positive direction. Your wins that you have hopefully direct you in a positive direction. I think it's important to be 10 foot tall and bulletproof, but you for a period of time. Right. But you have to learn from that, and you have to make solid decisions. And I think as a parent, one of our most important roles, and I would advise this to you, and I think you probably know this because your kids are still quite a bit younger than what mine are, and I've been through that phase, is to know when to just back off and be like, you know what?
Right.
I can only advise you so much, and you're going to screw up here. You might physically get hurt. I don't want to see that happen for many reasons. You might emotionally get hurt, whether it's a relationship or, you know, a career path or an opportunity doesn't work out that they dreamed of. But you're going to learn from this, and I'm going to be there for you on the backside of this to help dust you off and support you and give you words of encouragement. And you know what? If we have to, we'll figure it out together. And I think that's probably your most important role, especially as you're, I mean, when your kids are little, your most important role is just keeping them breathing, you know? But once they get older, I think that's probably your most important role as a parent. You know, in some degrees, ways, it's that way in a marriage too, you know? I mean, I look at going, you know, my wife and I have been married, it'll be 32 years this fall, and we've been together 37 years as of like the spring. So a long time. And, you know, not that it's been perfect. Hell, God knows it hasn't been. But, you know, there's just a lot that you learn in that time together as being there to pick each other up, dust each other off. When they're having a bad day, you be the one that's strong enough to have a good day or fake like you're having a good day so that you can pick them up and vice versa. I realize it's a team effort, and it's so right. easy to, in a marriage, get into fights about kids, parenting styles, what you believe your kids should be into or doing versus what the other, your spouse does. Obviously financial is always a huge issue in every marriage. And people change too in life. I mean, my wife is a totally different person than she was when she was 20 years old and we were dating, and when we were 30 years old and first having kids. She's a totally different woman. She's been through experiences that I can't even fathom. Childbirth, you talk about your knee thing. My wife literally flipped her knee completely backwards, like a chicken leg goes, where her toes and heel were in her face. On two occasions, she has a cadaver ligaments in her one knee, and she's gone through, I mean, I had to watch it from the outside, and I can't even imagine, it was so painful watching. I can't imagine what she went through. And so my point is, she's a totally different person based on her life experiences. I'm a totally different person to her based on my life experiences. And it's just important to be there for each other, to pick each other up and be cheerleaders, and sometimes get in their shit and call a spade when you've got to. Yeah. But for the most part, really be there to support each other and say, you know, this sucks, but we're going to figure it out. You know, and I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like, but we are going to figure it out, because right. there's no other choice.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. I like this conversation. A little bit of hunting industry, a little bit of hunting community, a little bit of life at the end here. And I think this is a really good conversation. So Derek, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with me for this hour and a half here. So thank you very much. And I hope you have a good rest of your day, man.
Dude, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on here. Been listening to you for a long time and appreciate all that you do and your hard work. And if I could just plug one thing, if people could go to YouTube, go to New Day Outdoors, please check out my channel. Hit the subscribe button. I know that sounds so lame, but YouTube's algorithms anymore, they're killing us YouTube creators. All of us, and we talk about it, and subscriber counts are way down. Views are way down across the board for people. And we in this community need to support each other. So please go to New Day Outdoors. Look me up on social media. Follow me. Do all that stuff. We need each other. I promise I'll be there to engage with you. So please do it. We need to support each other as a community. So,
amen. All right. Good vibes your way. If anybody here is still listening to this, please go to iTunes or Spotify, wherever you download the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate that. Outside of that, the Nine Finger Chronicles has its YouTube channel too, which is just a video version of this. So go subscribe to that. Outside of that, everybody, good vibes in, good vibes out, and we'll talk to you all next time.